The culture war, there are no winners, just podcasters. Only a few are willing to risk their lives in the face of some of the dumbest ideas to have ever captured human civilization. Every week, we, Megan Dom and Sarah Hayter, humbly accept this mission to bring you conversations that are equal parts stunning, brave, and in a protected class all our own. Welcome to a special place in hell. Sarah, we are in a protected class. I feel that we are an identity category.
We are podcasters?
The two of us together. I feel like we could like form our own identity.
We should try.
Yeah, and it's definitely marginalized.
Mm-hmm. Bad podcasters.
Until we get some more subscribers. We're definitely oppressed and marginalized.
Lots to talk about.
Yeah. Yep. J.K. Rowling in trouble again.
Or not in trouble.
Not in actually. Trouble. Yeah, not, who knows?
Not, you know, we thought she was going to get arrested and then it didn't happen.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah, the question is, what's the matter with Scotland?
What is it? Honestly.
I don't know.
We need to have a Scottish person who we can understand. They need to speak in an American accent.
And we might have to have a translator. But if we could have a Scottish person to explain why Scotland is so woke, it's like they're competing. I think that it's like they want attention. Maybe they feel marginalized. So, yeah. So there was this law that just went into effect on April 1st, ironically enough, the Hate Crime Public Order Act in Scotland. So basically, it's been added to the existing hate crime legislation. So for the first time, hate crimes will be an offense, not just on the basis of race, but also other characteristics, protected class, age, disability, religion, sexual orientation, and transgender identity. And so basically the state can now decide whether what you're thinking even is reasonable or hateful. Those are the categories. So if you say or communicate, if you say something or if you communicate material, tweeting, I guess, would count, that a reasonable person would consider to be threatening or abusive with the intention of stirring up hatred based on protected characteristics, you could be arrested.
So, I don't understand Europe, period. Every time I read about...
Well, there's not Europe.
Speech. I mean, the continent and surrounding islands, it just feels as if they have this very bizarre fascist like strain, you know, a little touch of authoritarianism. It never left them. Mm-hmm. It's still there. They still want to control people's speech. It's unbelievable how many hate crime laws and legislation to control like online speech has been passed or attempted in various countries in Europe. I noticed a big rise since like the election of Donald Trump. Then there was like a big stir again to try and control the internet.
Yeah, well, and since Brexit as well.
Yeah, so, but then I just don't understand it. Maybe it's just.
They don't have the pioneer spirit that we do. I mean, there is a Wild West tradition in the U.S. and you know,
it's offensive to my character. Like it's offensive to me in some very deep sense that someone would try to, you know, some judge somewhere will get to decide whether my speech was an abusive speech or. Yeah. Threatening to a reasonable person. I mean, even if it was, that standard just still doesn't make sense. You still don't know my intentions,
right?
You know, maybe it still didn't do any harm. There are still words.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah. I mean, and what is a reasonable person?
Right.
Yeah. I mean,
what is
there, there are even very if, few.
How many? I mean, if you get in a fight, you're in middle school, you get in a fight, you say, "I'm going to kill you," you know, and. Mm-hmm. Maybe to a reasonable person, that is the way that it seems. that you're gonna kill that person, or maybe in the middle of a fight, and it's a possibility. Physical harm is a real possibility there, but still, like, what? How? It's still not a crime in itself, and it shouldn't be. It's unbelievable. I don't understand it. It's so contrary to my character.
Yeah,
I'm glad I'm here. I'm glad I'm an American, I have to say.
Yeah, for now.
For a lot of reasons, but when I see stuff like this, I feel very...
Yeah.
It's not smug. I don't feel smug. I'm just... It's a relief, kind of, like...
Phew, well, it
like,
does. Thank God. I mean, like, but I know, and we go around squawking about how our rights are in jeopardy and, you know, the fascists are coming for us here, but... We do.
It's
still
not like
have
this.
Freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we can get fired by our private corporations and such.
Sure. But I mean, it's an interesting conversation that we could probably have at length some other time. And somebody should suggest, who's listening to this, should suggest a Scottish person who can parse the wokeness of Scotland, where it's stemming from, why they're so woke in comparison.
Right.
But I'm glad that despite her, you know, possible crime,
JK
Rowling did not get in trouble.
No, I know.
Though, she was intending, though, to offend people. She wasn't intending to abuse anybody or threaten or to harm anybody.
No.
Clearly, she was attending the offense, and she was intending to provoke. Wasn't she?
Right, but she's not intending to hurt people. That's the difference.
It's the intention of stirring up hatred. That's the language.
Right. No, I'm just thinking here it would be exactly. Sorry.
I think she fell in, and then they decided that they couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. That they couldn't actually legislate.
They've really created a bind for themselves, because if they go actually enacting this, they're going to look like fools, and they're also going to create martyrs.
Right.
It's going to have the absolute opposite effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to waste a lot of people's time, and they're going to be a laughing stock. So
yeah.
Maybe
they are
should...
a laughing stock. How can this be? How is this real?
The thing is, look, it's Scotland. They probably can't even understand what people are saying.
Right.
I think the reason they have these laws in Scotland is they know they can kind of mess around, because their language is like unintelligible. Mm-hmm. People could be saying anything. Mm-hmm. It all sounds like hate speech. I mean, I think it's certainly discriminatory against people from other places.
Against Americans.
Barely English. What is it? It's like a kind of just strange phonics. Kind of glottal. Yeah. Glottal.
Must agree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, if anybody wants to come on, but yeah, but how do you feel about JK? She does spend a lot of time on Twitter on about this. I can imagine that if you are sort of inclined to take offense, you're really going to think that she's like, kind of on overdrive.
I mean, she's obsessed with the issue, as are we, you know, so this is, it's great that she's part of the clan, as far as I'm concerned, but I can see how her language became more kind of extreme and direct, you know, more turfy as time went on.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see. Frankly, I like it. I'm always happy when people feel like, okay, I don't care anymore. I'm going to say it. I'm going to say the thing. I'm going to say it.
Right. But do you wish that she would be more serious? I mean, I'm always trying to get people to comport themselves, but I get it.
I think she needs to, she changed everything by speaking out. I think before she said whatever the original tweet, I remember, was like very, it was just in support of Maya, right? Like
Maya,
that's
Forrestatter.
What it,
yeah.
Yeah. It was something very benign and like not quite turfy, but everybody got the message. I think before then she had accidentally liked something turfy as well, which was hilarious, because everybody, I remember people made a big deal out of it, and they were like, oh my god, we knew it, you know, they were ready with their pitchforks, and other people were like, no, it was an accident, like this happens, like nothing, you know. But I knew in my heart, I was like, no, she is obsessively scrolling through TARF Twitter, and that was not that like meant something.
Mm-hmm.
It was only a matter of time till she came out. But it when she did, I think it just changed the atmosphere. It allowed a lot of people to step out of the outside, you know, what was respectable opinion, you know, mm-hmm. and say what they really think about the issue. I think she has been just key to the movement on Turf Island, and a real hero to me personally.
Yeah. I mean, the more I think about this, so much of the obsession with the danger that trans people are in, the, you know, the harms caused to them, the idea of being under constant threat, it is driven by AGPs and the way that victimization is a fetish to them. I mean, mm-hmm. wanting to be female is inherently tied up in feeling like a victim and feeling like you're in danger. And it's like part of the turn on is the idea that if you walk down the street, you're going to be in jeopardy. And I feel like people are not putting that together enough. I mean, you know, the idea that somehow like trans kids are in danger of committing suicide, like that is sort of a separate conversation and it has been disproved on its own. But like the fact is that fear is just an extension of this fetishization of harm that is totally driven by
HIV. A vulnerability of yes. being vulnerable. Yes.
Fragile, vulnerable. Yes.
The first time I ever heard somebody, like a real person who I knew existed in real life and had, you know, seen in real life, say that they were literally shaking over something, over like just a disagreement, mm-hmm. was a trans woman. Mm-hmm. Like some dude, you know, 20
because that's what women do. They literally shake.
And I remember thinking, you're a joke. Like what? I've never heard a woman say this. Or, you know, I've seen them shake, but not usually in response to words alone or a uncomfortable argument. Like really it's an emotional circumstance, some serious situation, and then I think the adrenaline is pumping through people and then that's what happens. But I don't take it as it was just an odd thing to say, and it was
it's a teenage girl would say that. I mean, they want to be teenage girls.
Would teenage girls say, I'm literally shaking?
Yeah, oh my God. Oh my God, you guys, I'm freaking out. I'm totally freaking out. Oh my God, I'm literally shaking. I can see that as sort of part of it.
But they're exaggerating. They're making it up. I'm dying, I'm screaming, I'm whatever. You know, but that's not what this was.
I'm dead.
This was in response to, this was in response to like an online argument. And then they were saying that they were literally shaking.
Yeah, I mean, it really is.
I was struck by that. I was like, you're not.
It is emotional blackmail.
You're not passing the smell test, really.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, this movement is committing emotional blackmail on just a massive scale. And people need to understand.
It's working on men. That's what's weird. It's weird to me when it works on men. When, like, lefty men are just like, we have to protect this fragile flower. And I'm like, you know you're talking about, like, a 250-pound.
God, do they even believe it?
Or do you know who you're talking? This is not a... I don't know. I think some of them do believe it. Like, in the sense that they live in a very social world. And I think to be a man who has achieved any kind of success or status amongst a certain kind of crowd, you have to be somebody who's willing to play these games or able to do it really well, even lie to yourself and believe it yourself so that you can convincingly pass off as more feminist than the last feminist or more, you know, anti-racist than the last guy. You know, I think they, I don't know. Do you think they're lying?
Well, it might just be a matter of, you know, you don't want to punch down. If they were to criticize a trans woman, they would be like hitting somebody with less power. I mean, it's kind of it's unmanly. It's violating certain social norms of being a man. You're picking on somebody smaller than you.
So it must also be, I think I remember I had a conversation like on Twitter about this, like with somebody, because I was so puzzled by this, that there would be men, basically they're men defending other men, you know, like and their ability, their freedoms to enter my bathroom. And I remember being just struck by it, this like opposite of chivalry thing happening. But I think that you must be right that what's underlying it a little bit is their confusion as to who is exactly vulnerable here, and they place the trans woman as beneath me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bad look.
Me, yeah.
It would be like beating up an effeminate.
But that I am beating them up, you know, like
right.
I'm the aggressor
right.
attacking me, like they're defending the poor yeah. trans women who's done nothing, no harm to anybody, really. And, you know, it's just.
Yeah, I kind of feel like at this point, the people who are saying, why are you so obsessed with this? They tend to be men. More and more, they're men because they haven't thought about it.
I only see it as men. Like,
I get some women saying it. But
I see almost entirely it's men. And I think it's because they know they can't defend it on the face of it. They can't. If they wanted to get into the actual argument, they kind of like some part of their brain knows that there's not something, there's something irrational here. There's something going on. But I think that they don't know enough. Two, they might be cowards and
or they're afraid of their wives. It has that sort of flavor of like being afraid of your wife. Like, I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. Like, it reminds me of it in Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's like the Jeff and Susie dynamic. It's like, you know, what Jeff Garland is so afraid of the Susie.
I'm afraid
Esmond
of my daughter,
character.
Actually, in this case, I think
maybe
I'm afraid of my daughter.
Or,
yeah.
Or if the wife is going along with it, if the mother is going along with it, it's sort of like, okay, I'm staying out of this. I'm the dad. This is between my wife. My wife knows better. Happy wife, yeah. happy life. Let's just yeah. move on. It's kind of that vibe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think daughters play a big role, especially with like girl dads, I guess, in how accepting they are of all this, because of friends, you know, they see friends
yeah.
of the daughter who are they thems and whatever she hers whatever that you know,
yeah.
all these cross-sexed people, and they want their daughters to love them and not be their conservative dad who just doesn't understand, you know. And
yeah, or if it's a boy, they don't want to come across like a homophobic dad. I mean, it gets all mixed up in that, like why I don't want to be the one that's like, be a man, son. Like, it's
yeah. I can't wait to be not that dad, but that mom, I guess. I will be that mom.
I can't wait till all 10 of your children trans. That's going to be
great. I don't know what. I don't know what I would do. I guess I would move. I would do what Abigail Schreier suggests.
It's going to be like the Duggar family meets Jazz Jennings. You should have a reality show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just not going to let them on social media.
Like, 12 this kids like, transing.
That's outrageous.
Yeah.
But maybe by that time, you know, I do think that this is like I've been thinking a lot about that Andrea Long Chu piece. I think that the fundamental logic is the logic that our society is running on, which is you should be allowed to do this because it is if it is possible, then it should be allowed, so long as it is not, quote unquote, hurting other people, you know.
Yeah. Well, the problem is it's not really possible.
If it did become possible?
It's not possible. I mean, this is what people don't understand. The surgeries don't work. The
right.
medicalization doesn't work. It's not possible. Do you know what
is possible to pretend that it is possible, and that's what they're asking.
Yes. Did you know that there's such a thing as National Unicorn Day? Have you heard this? April 9th.
No.
Is National Unicorn Day. So I was going to buy a birthday card for my for a friend who her birthday is April 9th. And I was like, wow, why are all these unicorn cards? Like, why is everything, what is with this? There's like a unicorn card section. And then I was going to the checkout at the supermarket, and the checkout woman was like, oh, I got my friend a joke card. We get each other like silly joke, cheesy joke cards every year for our birthdays. And she's like, oh, what a cute unicorn card. How fun. You set for this for National Unicorn Day? And apparently this is a thing.
No.
Yes, it is. Look it
no.
up. It is. And
I
so, but it's
it
just like, and I guess.
Why?
Because people are really into unicorns, and like it really says so much that this creature that doesn't exist has taken on like these giant symbolic power.
Just like little girls that are like, but it's fueling more, this. Well, because that's okay. Girls. That's cute if it's like a 6-year-old who.
But it also like is a gender. I mean, there's a gender thing to it, like the gender unicorn. And you know, it's interesting that the unicorn. Yeah, I mean, the unicorn has come to symbolize all this stuff, and they talk about like somebody being a unicorn if there's nobody else like them. I mean, this is a metaphor and a kind of figure of speech that has come up more and more. But I find it like so telling that. What we are choosing to take as a symbol for our sort of current times is something that just doesn't exist, yeah. Is not reality.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so
yeah, I think that we should. Focal point of discussion isn't what is real and what isn't real, but like, I think this is where I think Andrea Long Chu is correct, that it will shift in the direction of, why does it matter, or how much should it matter that it is not real, you know?
Yeah.
And his argument is that it doesn't matter. And I think that more and more people will start to agree with that, because even reality is, it is oppressive, right? Because we don't choose it. It is unfair to people. Some yeah. people are in reality smarter and prettier and the sex, a certain sex and in a certain position. And so, this is kind of the end point of so much of radical egalitarianism and the kind of thought process that fuels it, which is not what they wanted. And I don't think that they would agree with it. Many of them would agree with that today. But I think that that is where it's headed, whether we like it or not. And it's going to be messed up when we get there. I hope I'm not around, frankly. I just don't want to participate in that argument at all.
Yeah.
Who will stop them? You know, who will stop the AGPs?
Yeah. Who will stop the AGPs? It's got to be some other initials.
It has like, to be only another like, fetish could like defeat this fetish.
Yeah.
Frankly.
Right.
Because in order to really shut it down, we have to be a much more sex negative society than we are. You know,
honey. I know.
Well, no, we have to have a completely different set of assumptions about how people should live, what is acceptable, what is unacceptable. And unfortunately, this is like the way that we live now. It's the AGP man's world.
But the funny thing is that we are in a sex negative society for all the obsession with sexuality and identities and polycules and all that. People are not having any sex at all. It's the least sexy culture.
That's why AGP is perfect, because they're not having sex either. They're just like, they're in love with the idea of themselves. They're masturbating all the time.
With their imaginations.
Right, right, right. Which is why they're perfect, right? Like this is the end game. We all just sort of have sex with our ideas of ourselves.
We don't think that AGPs get together like and have sex with other AGPs.
Please don't talk about it.
I think they probably do.
Can move on.
Okay, sorry. All
but
right.
They do.
I knew we would.
They do.
It's. But yeah, I know. I just we've never lived in less sexy times. It seems.
It's true.
Sex obsessed, and
deeply unsexy.
Sexless.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Okay. So what else are we going to talk about? There's a book on the bestseller list. I know your favorite list. I know we take that very seriously, called White Rural Rage. I know you as a person who is neither white nor rural, but full of rage. Mm. I know you have some things to say about that.
Yeah, but it paints rage as a negative thing. So this is why it's not a book for me, really. It's a book against me.
It turns out that this, I feel like with this book, it's sort of like, you know, 1998 called and it wants its talking points back. I mean, how is this that different than, what's the matter with Kansas?
Thomas yeah. Or Frank? Like 20, even 20, 2017, maybe, you know, like,
yeah,
right at the point at which Trump was a new thing and we were horrified.
Right.
And at that point, this made sense.
Yeah. So this idea that only kind of hillbilly MAGA types are voting for Trump, that dies hard. But it's clearly not correct. Mm-hmm. And this book has been now called into question some of its sourcing.
Yeah. So the book is about, well, it's about the title, White Rural Rage. But the thesis is that this America, white rural America, is just the biggest threat to our democracy. That's what they, that's the thesis. I saw them on Morning Joe. I saw that you linked it.
Yeah,
and I saw it and it was,
yeah.
Who is this? Who's the other woman? So there's Joe, but then there's the blonde. Who's she?
Mika Brzezinski?
Yes, Mika. Okay. Yeah. Yes, Mika. What does she do? Why is she there? She's always just.
Her father was a very big. Was he like an economist or? He was a. He was a diplomat. He was a. He was counselor to Lyndon B. Johnson, and he was Carter's national security advisor in the late 70s into 81. So she's very much a daughter of. Political realm.
Okay, but she didn't seem like she had a lot of intelligent things to add to this. They were just like saying a bunch of stuff about,
well, what do you expect?
White rural America, and she's like, oh my god, TV.
Yeah.
It's like, just, you know, I just did not understand. I don't understand. So we haven't read the book. We should say that before we start talking about it. And are we going to read the book? Should I read the book? I can read pretty fast.
Oh, okay.
But it turns out that the research is all wrong. So I'm just going to be misled.
Okay. A lot of it is wrong. Not all necessarily, but
a lot of it.
Some of the studies that sort of are the core, guiding the logic of the book turn out to have been misinterpreted by the authors.
There was a piece on Reason about it, about the truth about rural rage. And I saw another piece on Politico. It seemed like some of the scholars that were quoted in this book, or whose research was cited in the book, have stepped out to say that either that was being misinterpreted, or that was not how it should be, taken, and that's not quite what it meant, or they can't, it doesn't, it implies certain things, but it doesn't really say those things outright. But it was interesting to see the pushback, and there was a piece on The Atlantic more recently by Tyler Austin Harper, who's an assistant professor of environmental studies at Bates College. What does that mean, environmental studies?
Like probably the environmental studies department. Tyler Austin Harper, he's like all over the place now.
He has good tweets.
He's a contributor at Harper's, and he tweets a lot, and he's a black guy.
He's black?
Yeah. At least partially. He's not, he's a POC.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to look him up. I mean, that's a very white guy name though, don't you think? Tyler Austin Harper.
Oh, I think that could go both ways.
Okay. Okay. Now I see. So he's blackish. I wouldn't have necessarily said he was.
Yeah. But he talks in the piece about being from Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, and, you know, so many of these places that, you know, can be called rural because they have like outskirts of town and they are not urban centers. Mm-hmm. They have so many different elements. Right. And there's like a lot of people who are not white living in these places. And there's a hell of a lot of people who are not white voting like, quote unquote, conservative white working class people, including in cities. So this entire construct is just really dated at this point. I know people in New York City who are voting for Trump, like quite a few.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Tyler Austin Harper tweeted a thread. So he wrote a piece on The Atlantic, and he also tweeted about this. I'm going to read from the tweets, obviously. But he's no, because I'm locked out. I'm locked out of The Atlantic.
You're too cheap.
My one.
Try another browser.
Okay, look. It was. I did a whole thing, and it just failed. It knows me now. It's tracking me somehow. But he says. The fantasy that rural places are hotbeds of right-wing violence doesn't just tap into old fears of scary hillbillies. It appeals because it allows suburbanites to imagine that the threat is over yonder, ignoring the scarier truth: the right-wing extremists are their neighbors. So he went, in order to look up this story, he talked to a lot of the same scholars that were cited in the book, and also other scholars about, you know, who look into rural America and like sociology of like those places. And it was interesting to see how much what he found was really discrediting the thesis of white rural rage. But this point, it's by itself is really interesting to me. Anyway, he goes on to say, one scholar told me that the number of votes Trump received in Los Angeles County was equivalent to the number of votes he received in the 633 most rural U.S. counties combined. Coastal liberals like to imagine the scary Trump voters are in middle America, not in good places like L.A. I found it baffling that so many smart and educated people, including the authors of White Rural Rage, can look at the evidence that there's a much greater threat coming from cities and suburbs and simply ignore it or misinterpret it in favor of the violent Hick hypothesis. So he says that this white rural rage hypothesis is a defense mechanism, a security blanket for liberals who are terrified, not unreasonably, about threats to democracy and authoritarian violence. It gives their terror an object and puts the object at a distance far removed from their homes. What do you think about this thesis? Because I was wondering, I can't, you know, fully, given how what we know about the increasing, you know, brownness of the Trump base.
Yeah.
It's odd to see a book like this published, and it's so weirdly racialized. I think it's off-putting. It, as you said, it's dated. You know, like maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, this would have worked, but now it just doesn't. It doesn't seem to sit right, even yeah. in the liberal mind, like the progressive standard New York Times progressive mind. So why are they still doing it? You know,
well, because obviously it works. It's on the bestseller list. The publisher was right to publish it. I mean, they're going to do the math.
So white people are buying this, right? Like this is.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, people who watch MSNBC are buying it because it's confirmation bias. I mean, if you want
to. And you
have...
think it's you agree with Tyler Austin Harper that this is a defense mechanism, like this is a security blanket.
I mean, I don't look. I mean, that's
the enemy's over there, and not yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think it's. I think people. Well, look, because if you live in the city, people who are publishers and people who are journalists. I mean, these two guys are they're journalists. I mean, Paul Waldman is written for. Does he write for the Washington Post? I can't remember. You know, he writes for all the, you know, respectable legacy media outlets and has for a long time. If you live in Washington, D.C. or New York, you just assume that people who vote for Trump live like in West Virginia somewhere. And it doesn't occur to you that if you go to Cleveland or Pittsburgh or any number of places, there's a whole lot of different kind of people living in these places. It's quite diverse. And I just think they just don't think of it. And, you know, so one of the scholars that, you know, is saying that her research was misconstrued is Kristen Luntz Trujillo, who she's a political science professor at University of South Carolina. So she wrote a piece in Newsweek, White Rural Rage Cites My Research. It gets everything wrong about rural America. Gets everything about rural America wrong. That's the title of the piece. I'm sure she didn't. That's not her words. But, you know, she says the book makes the claim that the root problem in our politics today lies squarely on the shoulders of white rural Americans. Yet it makes a lot of negative assertions about this group without the methodological rigor or correct characterization of existing literature to back it up. So the authors make the claim that white rural Americans are rampantly conspiratorial to the detriment of society. Yet they find that less than a quarter of them believe in conspiracy theories such as QAnon. And though this is 7 percentage points higher than urban Americans, that difference in QAnon loses statistical significance when controlling for other factors. Okay, so it's not a distinctively rural phenomenon. I can tell you that's true. I mean, the number of people I run into who believe in some variation of QAnon stuff, like in Los, I run into them all over the place. I mean, they're your Uber
and
driver.
Are they white?
Yeah, some of them. Yes,
some of them. Yeah,
not all of them. A lot of them are. A lot of them are Hispanic. A lot of them are immigrants. A lot
immigrants
of them
love conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, talk to your Uber driver next time.
Talk to my mom. Like, you'll hear all kinds of stuff, but it's unbelievable. It doesn't really map onto our politics super well.
It's
but.
Not. Yeah. I mean, and also like, I mean, go to, yeah, this go to Texas, okay? There's a lot of people living in these towns that are not white.
I remember being very annoyed by that when I first left Texas and just explored, you know, what northeastern cities. I was in Boston for a little bit, and I remember how much people misunderstood about Texas. It was just like a really common thing to think about Texas as like actual cowboy land of only white people. And, you know, Texas is, with the exception of Austin, which is ironically like the whitest little city in Texas, everywhere else, like all the other major metropolitan areas are super diverse. You know, San Antonio is Latino, basically. They have a political machine there, actually. You know, El Paso, Houston is extremely diverse. Houston is not just diverse in the sense of a ton of Latinos, but just people all over the world, you know, are in Houston. A lot of South Asians are in Houston. It's just, I think it's just odd and frankly ignorant. You know, it's just ignorant.
It's provincial.
It's ignorant to say these kinds of things about Texas that only exists in your imagination. Why don't you just go visit and take a look and walk around and see what it looks like?
Well, that's just anecdotal evidence. That's just lived experience.
But I think it was like University of Houston is like the most, one of the most diverse universities in, I think it might be the most diverse, depending on what you, how you count it. But in the United States, like it's extremely diverse. And there's like universities all down, like the, you go down the coast and it just gets more and more brown until you end up in like McAllen. And that's just everyone's brown. Yeah. Everyone's speaking Spanish only, like you've entered Mexico pretty much. And that's Texas. That's Texas too. Those people vote too. And they don't vote the way that you think.
No,
vote.
I remember talking with somebody in New York one time and she was like a, you know, dyed in the wool New Yorker. And we're talking about border crossings and immigration. And, you know, I said something like, well, you know, the border patrol guys are like largely Hispanic. And she was shocked. She had like never thought of that.
Of course,
never
they are.
Thought of that.
They
like,
have to be. Think, where are they going to come
because
from?
Because I think they're thinking of that movie, The Border, with Jack Nicholson with his, you know, mirror aviator glasses looking menacing. I know it's an old movie, but no, it's New Yorkers are the most provincial people in the country, and they are running the media.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening, and you know, you can get far turning your nose up at this, you know,
it's just ignorant.
The problem too is like, but here's the problem. If they were going to write a book called Stupid People, you know, under-informed stupid people rage, they would have to talk about more than just white people, and then it would be racist. If you put white in front of anything, then that gives you cover to insult the subject all you want. White women. You're not a misogynist if you're complaining about white women.
Yeah. You're not a classist when you're complaining about rural America if it's white only. You exclude all the the brown people and black people who are voting the same way. They're voting the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see how this discussion emerges.
I don't even think it is a discussion. I do think that Tyler Harper, what is his name?
Tyler Austin Harper.
Tyler Austin Harper. It is a white guy name. Come on.
You know, it sounds like a Southern name. I can't believe he's from Pennsylvania. It sounds like a Southerner, like
Harper,
like a Southern, like Harper. It sounds like a Southern Gothic writer kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know if I agree that what's happening here is simply this defense mechanism because they're too afraid to recognize that the Nazis are the Nazi call is coming from within the house. But it is true. And I think it's interesting that I've seen so many suburban right wingers and they definitely are the kinds of people who LARP as, you know, the trad people online, right? Like they're sort of LARPing in this way and fantasizing about rural America and what it means to them, and they're the ones that are participating in these culture war fights online anyway, but I don't think many of those people are actually rural Americans. I think many of them are, you know, educated suburbanites. They go to these liberal arts or these liberal colleges and then come out hating that group of people and taking on and putting on these airs of, you know, ruralness or connectedness to the people. But I think many of them are just as cosmopolitan and you know, elite but that's not exactly what they are talking about here. They're talking about like the Trump base itself, which is different than like online right wing like culture warriors.
Right.
That base, though, I mean, that base is diverse and it's increasingly diverse. Yeah. They're not that online. They're pretty normy. They just worry about different things. They think about the world in a different way. They're not that offended by the things that he says. You know, they're just not. I can't believe that when it first came to light that Latinos were shifting to Trump, you know, like or even that they weren't really scared off of him when he, you know, initially started to say all this horrible stuff about Hispanics, that, you know, but well, really he was talking about illegal immigrants more than anything else. But at that time, right then and there, that should have been a huge wake up call to every liberal elite, like political commentator, that something else is going on. These people they have a value system that is not what I think that it is. And I have to understand them. And I think there was like a drive to understand them like the first year after Donald Trump got elected, but right. It didn't last very long.
No,
at all.
And then the pandemic came
it was the Russiagate, remember?
Right. Oh yeah.
It was Russiagate immediately, like 6 months to a year where we got to pretend like we cared about Trump voters, and then it was Russiagate, and then COVID.
I mean, yeah, the very first article that came out, I remember in the New York Times after Trump was elected, maybe a day later, 2 days later, it was about, oh my gosh, there's this, you know, there are people on Staten Island who are Italian Americans who voted for Trump. Oh my gosh, these women, and they live on Staten Island. Oh my gosh. Okay, these are not rural Americans, unless you count Staten Island as rural.
Yeah.
The majority of Staten Island probably voted for Trump because that's where all the cops live, and I mean, and the first responders. I mean, the other thing too, that, you know, the BIPOC vote for Trump really highlights is that these people can't be hurt by words. You know, we're so now attached to the idea that words cause harm. And in the progressive sphere, that's like a core belief now, like words can do damage. I mean, and just the beginning of this conversation, we were talking about, you know, hate speech, and now this has been criminalized. And in fact, they don't, right? Like,
I think white people are very affected by words, or they must be, because it's doesn't make
they're the ones who can read. Other people don't know how to read.
I just don't understand how they can, you know. So this kind of like college kid thing, you know, of being very concerned about words, very, very worried about encountering hate or even disagreement or ideas that are counter to theirs. That feels unique to me. And it is racial in that there's a lot of white people, and that's like far, like sort of liberal lefty coalition. But nobody ever look around and just think, where are the brown people?
I mean, you know, it's this idea of the internal locus of control, right? Versus the external locus of control. So
what you mean by this.
Well, this comes out of psychology. I mean, they like to talk about this in the sort of resilience world. So if you have an internal locus of control, that means that if something happens on the outside, you are able to emotionally regulate and not be affected by it. Like, if you see something that's disturbing, or if somebody acts out or says something mean to you, you can make the choice and say, I can either choose to have this affect me, or I can choose to have it not affect me. But it's my choice. Mm-hmm. It's a sort of psychological agency.
Right.
And I mean, Abigail Schreier has been talking about this. You know, it's funny. I interviewed Nadine Strossen yesterday. I recorded an interview for the Unspeakable podcast. It'll come out in a few weeks. And you know, she talked all about this. It's this stuff seems so obvious, right? But the idea of words causing harm, it's not brand new, but you know, to have it be so just sort of baked in to our emotional responses, it's pretty new. Like, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Like, parents said that to their children for many, many generations. Mm-hmm. And at some point they stopped.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do wonder, like, just the kids who are going to come out of this, are they the ones who can survive and thrive in this atmosphere? Either they can navigate this kind of social landscape in which, you know, everything is offensive and you just have to worry about everybody's emotional response all the time. Or you can be like Trump and you don't care and you step on everything and you say, ha ha, when they cry. And that is in itself, that is also a kind of strength. That is also a way to get through it. And I think at some point it's going to be the only logical way to get through it, because there's just too many, there are too many things that you can't touch that are important for us to be able to have an honest and open conversation about.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, the gender issues being the most, the one on top of my mind when I think about this, but almost any policy issue that touches on a culture war or third rail becomes, you know, just an impossible thing for us to collectively work through as a people. I mean, it's just like, it's a true breakdown in discourse and in our ability to make sense together. You know, that we can just make sense apart as individuals online, like in front of our screens and talking to groups of random kind of subcultures online. And that's where we can parse what our world, you know, is and what we should be valuing, what we should be thinking about. But there's no public discourse in that same way anymore. And it's a lot of it has to do with this, with the fact that we just can't, there's some things that you just can't talk about, you can't question, and you're too afraid to do it in, you know, in front of a person who might be personally offended.
Yeah, I mean, look what happened with the COVID response. I mean, now suddenly the school lockdown thing, the New York Times is saying, oh, okay, well, it looks like we might have gotten that wrong and we're kind of walking that back now. It's too late.
It's too late. Those kids are like, they're going to be behind for life. No, they're not going to catch up.
And the idea that people who were questioning that are racists,
yeah,
it's offensive to the nth degree. It is completely unacceptable. You cannot run a society when people who ask very basic questions based on what is right in front of them, when those people are shut down as racist, which is pretty much the worst thing you can be called at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, that will silence anybody. The society is going to collapse.
Well,
literally,
more people are going to vote for people like Trump who don't care at all, you know, and the signal that they were getting when he was saying all these offensive, horrible things was not they weren't voting for that horrible thing, you know. And I think that it's just it's frustrating that nobody is quite grasping this still on the left, that they're not kind of just sort of tolerating it or agreeing with it or anything like that. They're getting a totally different signal. And the signal they're getting from him saying that is, I don't care what these people want me to be sensitive about. You know, like these rules don't apply to me. That's what he was saying. That's what they were voting for. They were voting for somebody who says, this has no control over me, what I say and what I do. And that's what they wanted from a leader. And that's what they're now more increasingly black and brown people are moving in his direction. Come on. Mm-hmm. Like, can there be a bigger signal as to, like, literally their vote? They're literally changing their votes. And you're not going to see this impact the messaging of the left at all. At all. It's not, they're not going
to,
they're still,
well, they don't have anyone to
racist.
Do it. Who was going to, who do they have? Yeah.
Well, I mean, they only need a few, right? Like, you only need a few sort of token minorities. You elevate them.
Right, right.
They call everybody racist all the time. And that's it.
No, that's what I mean. But who would the Democrats even send that would be able to give a reasonable message at this point? Like, they don't have anybody. There's nobody on the bench. There's nobody that they, I mean, both sides are completely both bankrupt. Both this
completely
point.
Screwed. Yeah. But, I mean, that's just politics.
Yeah. No, but we could all use a little Trump, I suppose. We could all use a little bit of not caring if people hate us.
But I think it's disgusting, too, the way that they throw rural people, like, and white rural. I see white rural America as the most oppressed, you know, in actuality. You know, in reality, these are the people that nobody cares about, nobody thinks about. And worse, if they do think about them, it's in this way. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're thinking about them, it's because they're the enemy. And I think it's just, it's repulsive that this, these two, I guess, journalists, wannabe scholars, or potentially some of them.
They're journalists.
One of them, you know, none of them are academics. Neither of them are academics. Out of the two.
Well,
I thought they
Waldman
were.
Is a journalist. Maybe. I'm not sure.
Okay.
You know. It's not an academic book. It's a current affairs book.
So. Right, but what good does this do to villainize this group like that? I don't think it's a defense mechanism thing. That's what I don't think. Mm. But I think there's something else going on that I can't quite put my finger on. I saw an interesting tweet about this relating to this a couple of weeks ago. I think I sent it to you. But it was by this guy named Hussein Abu Bakr Mansour. I like him. He converted to Judaism. He was an ex-Muslim and then
he's
Jewish. Yeah.
Got it all.
Interesting guy. So he said this, and I thought it was a really smart way to put it on Twitter. He said, "I have actually seen a lot of conspiracies during my life, but they are much less grand than many portray them and usually very pathetic. One of the common pathetic ones I usually see is when some American white elite aspirant meets a Middle Eastern counterpart, and the egotistic desire for the former to be superior to his grandparents and cousins living in Missouri meets the desire of the latter not to feel to have originated from a region that is inferior to Western societies. And they both tacitly conspire and bond over the denigration of racist America and the religious fundamentalist Bible Belt that is as bad as the Taliban. Thus, the superiority complex of the first merges with the inferiority of the second, finding sweet release in their beautiful conspiracy of mutual validation."
Wow, that's erotic. I thought that was, it's like a circle jerk, circular firing squad.
Yeah. He has another second part of it. It was, he said, "Aside from seeing it being repeated, I actually had the pleasure of being invited to it multiple times. It happened suddenly and smoothly in the middle of a conversation with someone, usually a young white person, who in the middle of the conversation invites you to the conspiracy by expressing how terrible America is or how his cousins somewhere in Idaho are Trumpers and said something very racist last Thanksgiving dinner. It's like a dance in which the person made the first move and is waiting for you to reciprocate, hop on the floor and join them in this little delightful conspiracy. It's become my secret joy to actually then reject the invitation politely. Judging by the common shocking reactions I received, I presume that declining the invitation is quite uncommon." Anyway, that's mm-hmm. I think that's,
yeah,
a funny way to put it, but I there's something to that. There's something to "I'm not like them" that seems to be ruling the desire to paint them in this awful, awful way. But because I can't make sense of it otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, I too, you know, one of these, you know, there's a point made by this scholar from South Carolina, Kristen Trujillo. You know, she was saying that, you know, people in rural areas, usually it's more that they feel proud of where they are from more than that they hate other places. Mm-hmm. And like in the other, with the other, you know, with people in urban areas, it's the other way, right? They hate the other. Mm-hmm. And it's like wherever they are is just whatever. It's like they wouldn't even think to be proud of it because that's like a regionalist impulse.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, people who are like really proud to be from New York, you know, those are not the elites.
No.
Those are the working class.
Those are the Italians.
The Italians, right.
The Catholics.
Or, yeah, or like, you know, anyone who's been there for a couple of generations. So it's, yeah, there's something about regional pride is a sort of a signifier of
low class,
downwardly. Yeah, it's a down market. Signal. Yeah.
And I think it makes sense to me that like the aspiring class, like, so that's how he phrased it. Some aspiring elite aspirant, white elite aspirant, makes sense to me that they are the people who are most sensitive to this messaging and really want to be, I'm not from there, I'm not like them, because they are so close. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if we had a kind of really entrenched elite that was truly like an aristocracy and not something many of us could do much about, and there wasn't a lot of mobility, you wouldn't really have this sense of elite unease and anxiety about differentiating themselves from, you know, where they came from.
Yeah.
Because they would be comfortable, you know, they would be comfortable as, you know, this is my right by birth that I am where I am and I feel comfortable with it. And so I can even be very benevolent to people poorer than me or on lower down the social ladder.
Yeah. I mean, if you're holding on by your fingernails, you're going to act out. My parents were like that. I mean, my parents were from white rural. I mean, not white. There are a lot of black people there. I mean, my parents were from Southern Illinois, okay, which is sort of neither here nor there. It's a very Southern kind of culture. Mm-hmm. But my father especially was very, very poor. Mm-hmm. And my parents spent their whole lives like trying to show that they were not from there. I mean, it was an absolute obsession. Mm-hmm. You know, especially on my mother's part, just every single second was, oh, I'm not from there. I've come so far. I disavow all of that. I really belong here. And they never belonged. It was a total lie.
Right.
And, well, it caused a lack of generosity, I think, because they were never fully able to feel comfortable or like they had arrived. They never arrived.
And that actually that's the sign of a true like born elitist who's going to stay there and doesn't feel, you know, uncomfortable or anxious about retaining that status.
Yeah.
But I think there's something about just being we're not in a very mobile society. And I know nobody agrees. Like on the left, people think that we are not very mobile.
Late capitalism.
But of course we are. Like they have just haven't been in a society where there's no mobility at all. And that's why they can say this. But there are, you know, there are societies where there's just like no mobility at all. And there used to be everywhere entrenched actual, you know, aristocracy that you couldn't do much about. And I think that was the time in which you could have benevolent elites who saw themselves serving the people in a kind of in the kind of generous way I think we no longer see. And I think there's something about the way that we structure our society. There's something about the fact that we really are a meritocracy. We really are socially mobile, both up, you know, you can move up, you can move down. And that causes a lot of class anxiety, especially among the elites who really want to. Now they, you know, they treat people beneath them in this really aggressive way. Outwardly aggressive, too.
Yeah, they're not nouveau like, riche. Well, they're, it's like
we're all new. We're all that way all the time. You know, there's no other way. There's no other. Because no one is secure in being at the top except for the very, 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 very rich. But even they are not as secure as they used to be in their top dog status, because you could have a little Elon Musk who can, you know, come out of nowhere
and
be
mega rich.
Then he's the king, you know? Yeah. And I think that mobility itself has created this kind of anxiety that has led to an elite class that just doesn't have this, you know, this instinct
doesn't have
of protectiveness.
Class.
Yeah, it doesn't have class, right? And why would they? So I it was occurring to me the other day when
you know
I
what
about.
It's funny. I'm just thinking as you're talking that I used to think of college professors as the embodiment of that kind of classy elite. And
yes,
I thought, well, they even if they don't have money, they have cultural capital, and they have the trappings of upper middle class and elite status, and they're going to conduct themselves in this classy way. They're going to be generous. They're going to have, like, you know, a house in the country and a beat up Volvo. And it is an old money ethos. And I thought the college professors absolutely embodied that. And in a way they did. I mean, in the old structure, they had a lot of capital, and they were kind of old white guys. Mm-hmm. And they knew how to, you know, treat people properly. I mean, they would hit on their students and do all sorts of terrible things, but, you know, that was an old money kind of vibe.
Other than the groping.
Yeah. So. And at a certain point, because the demographics of academia changed, mm-hmm. You have a whole lot of people in academia who are ascendant and come from humbler backgrounds and are very, have a scarcity complex and are very, have a lot of class
anxiety. My name is Dr. Whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, this is when you're
exactly. Yes. Yeah. I mean, because when I was in college, even, I mean, it would have been to call your professor doctor would have been an embarrassment. You call your professor by their first name, actually.
Oh,
yes, absolutely. And yeah, the professors who were secure with themselves would let you call them by their first name. And if at the very least, I mean, we would call them Mr.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? Mm. Or Ms.
That's weird.
And of course,
yeah,
they all have
weird.
PhDs, but it would have just been absolutely cringe.
I think I said professor. I said
professor is okay. Professor. But would you that's be like, oh, professor, like raise your hand and say professor? I mean, that's so weird.
I don't know what I would have said. Now that you've said, I'm blanking on what I actually said, but I'm sure I must have been professor, whatever. Professor,
yeah.
First name.
I mean, but it was a way of, you know, signaling that you were comfortable with yourself and that you were secure in your status. And now we've got all these total, like, RVs.
Newcomers.
Yeah.
Yeah, newcomers who are not secure, and they will claw their way into the system, and you'd better give them respect, and they're not going to be generous to the people beneath them, because they see themselves as, you know, that could have been me.
That's right.
If I hadn't, you know, done whatever, if I maybe got pregnant at the wrong time, that would have been me. I would have been like my cousins.
Yeah, no, that was absolutely my parents. I mean, they were just terrified. They kind of couldn't believe that they had gotten as far as they had, mm-hmm. but they never owned it.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's so much of what is wrong with our politics is that I think it's just we have powerful people who don't feel powerful, you know, or who are not comfortable in their status or in the
That's
fact
right.
that they will probably maintain it forever, but they just, they're anxious, their kids won't have it. So now they're freaking out, and it leads to a very toxic approach towards the public who they have a duty to, because now they are privileged, right? Like now, but I think it's that's a meritocracy problem, because they don't even see themselves as privileged. They see themselves as people who have earned their way.
Yeah,
to where
or
they have.
It's prosperity gospel. I mean, yeah.
And, but they even, I mean, this is especially true, I think, of the very lefty liberal ones who will never, who in other domains are happy to talk about privilege. But in this, in the fact that they have a doctor in front of their name and you have to call them doctor, they will defend that right to be called doctor to death, because they think they have earned it. They have earned that respect.
Yeah, especially
and
a
for
woman.
You to be.
Yeah.
If they're a brown woman, a black woman, yeah. How dare you?
Well,
you're signaling disrespect to me, you know. And then they have to be, you know. Beat back the rabble a little bit and remind them of their place.
I know.
That shift in the psychological profile of the kind of person who is taking up these important positions in our culture, aside from the fact that they're now, this is a female person. That's number one. So that exists. We've talked about that before. But then in addition to that, I think that person is just so much more anxious.
Right. But there would be a critique. I mean, but somebody would come in and say this has to do with capitalism, and there's an economic critique here. I'm not the one to make it because I don't know enough about that stuff. But they would say this has to do with economic precarity, and this has to do with globalism and just
status.
The fact that, well, but also like the fact that you cannot, you know, everybody feels precarious.
I don't think people feel the way that they used to, where it was like it, it's likely that we could starve. Like, that's not going to happen. We are living in times where goods are cheap, you know.
Yeah,
a sack of beans is cheap.
Okay,
we can argue about like the specifics of it. I don't know if housing is exactly in the same plane, but it is true that goods are cheaper than they've ever been before. Things like an iPhone would have been like, and a computer is affordable, right, in a way, and the computer can do amazing things in a way that it couldn't. So these kinds of goods, capitalist goods, really are cheaper and more affordable for the average person. And I think it's strange to say that the average middle class American is living in a like impoverished or, you know, just some kind of a sad little world when it comes to goods.
Well, when it comes,
you know,
to stuff,
I think
that's true.
When it comes to
but
stuff,
like, I mean,
I think we're rich in stuff.
People
are really rich in stuff.
Right. But if you look at housing, if you look at healthcare, medical debt can wipe somebody out in an instant. I mean, there are all kinds of things that put people at real risk. I mean, the amount of savings that most people have, it's shocking. They don't have any. I mean, the average person, I think, just has like such that if they were to, you know, have some kind of medical catastrophe or even, you know, half catastrophe happen, they would be absolutely screwed. I mean, people do lose their houses. I mean, it is very difficult. Yes, we have a lot of free crap that we can order from Amazon.
I think we just compare ourselves to the boomers and we think about what they had and we think we don't have exactly that. And so things are bad. But I think that if you look at a longer stretch of time than that, we're obviously doing pretty well. The average, like the floor is not as low as it was. It is unlikely that, like it used to mean that for you to really fall down, you know, be hard on your luck, you don't just lose a house and move into an apartment. You know, you lose your place of living and you are homeless. You know, you don't have a place to get
food. Well, there are
food.
Those people.
You
don't have, I mean, there are a lot of homeless people that are not on the street.
They exist,
they're living.
What do you mean they're not on
the
street?
I mean, well, there are a lot of homeless. I mean, we think of homeless people. We think of the people walking around on the street. But there are a lot of people who are couch surfing or living in their cars or living in hotels. I mean, there is a lot of that.
I don't think that they exist to the same, like, I don't think they exist to the same degree that they used to. I'm just saying there's fewer of them.
I'm not sure about that. I mean, we're both talking without any numbers here, so I'm not sure. But I do, you know, the floor is not as low, but that also means that the floor is higher. You can't afford a basic thing. I mean, I think the median home price in the U.S. is like $400,000. That's crazy for most people.
By floor, I mean, I mean in the sense that it's poverty doesn't mean what it used to mean. Like, poverty used to be a lower standard of living.
You were literally starving and you had, you know,
newspapers. Then it is now. Yeah. Now it means something else. And it's still bad.
Yes.
It's still bad. It's still very bad, but it's not what it used to be. And so I'm just saying that I think that we do live better lives materially.
For sure.
Not that there isn't scarcity. Not that there aren't problems. There aren't shortages, but that when it comes to goods and just having physical things, food, shelter, clothes on your back, we have all those things and we have more of them than we've ever had before.
Yeah.
But class status is what we're talking about.
Yeah, but class anxiety is not governed by how much food you have or don't have.
Right.
It has to do with whether or not you can afford to send your kids to college or you can afford to live in this
town.
Or
the right college. The elites are not talking about the people that I know who are really concerned about college admissions. They're not even looking at, you know, community college, like, God forbid, like, that's death, that's social suicide, it's an unimaginable horror to them that their child would go to a community college, even if it was like 2 years and then transfer into a different school. But that's a, you know, fate worse than death, like, as far as they're concerned. They don't even talk about it as if it's a realistic option.
In the meantime, there's really good professors at all these places because it's so hard to get a job, and the academic job market is such that, you know, politics aside, you're still going to get pretty good person even at a community college, because they can't get a job anywhere else.
So I think they do feel as if they need their kids to go to Stanford and they need their kids to go to, you know, Duke or wherever it is that they went, and they find that their kids can't compete because now there are up and comers who are working really hard and they've been prepping for their SAT since they were 5 years old
from all over the world. They're competing with the world.
Yeah. 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 They're competing with the smartest kids in India who have literally nothing better to do. You know, and their parents aren't even going to let them. And this is their shot. This is their one big shot, and they're going to take it. And I think that that it's just there's just a general level of status unease that is so uncommon. Up until now has been uncommon, you know, in terms of like human history and how the powerful and the noble, you know, like the upper class behave towards the common man or the lower classes. I think there's a sense of I could be like them, you know, if not for this and this and this, if not for a few of these things, maybe I'm just like the guy in Missouri.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yes. All right. Well, did we have anything else?
Did we?
I was going to rant about Woody Allen, but.
You want to? You can. I don't think we've gone on
I
got to
say,
long,
yeah. I mean, I it just. Okay, Woody Allen.
Wait, what are you talking about? Also,
well, Woody Allen's his 50th movie. Woody Allen has made a movie a year throughout his whole career. So he's just released his 50th film.
Crazy.
And what did you say? It's creepy?
It's crazy. Oh, crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. I know. You know, he's an artist that's not a neurotic artist. He just does it. He just does his work and puts it out there. Okay. And it hasn't been very good for the last several years. But apparently this new film, Coupe de Chance, is very good. And it got a good review in the Wall Street Journal. Nonetheless, the media coverage is still obsessed with how his career has been tainted, if not totally demolished, and he is a pedophile, and they cannot get past the idea that he supposedly married his stepdaughter, even though Sun Yi was not his stepdaughter, and she was not a teenager, and they've been married for, I don't know, 25 years now at this point, have two children. Mm-hmm. So Woody Allen, reputation bruised, finds muted reception to 50th film. I ruin the dinner party by starting to talk about Woody Allen, but enough with it. There's zero evidence that he molested Dylan Farrow. There's a whole bunch of evidence that Mia Farrow engineered the whole situation. We don't need to get into the weeds, but enough. Please, enough. And I'm looking at the comments. It's always just like, he married his daughter. He's disgusting. I mean, people go berserk about this and they don't know the details. Mm-hmm. And all of the media establishment basically is just kind of going along with this Me Too, Mia Farrow narrative, this documentary, Allen v. Farrow, that came out maybe 5 years ago. It was just an absolute piece of propaganda. I'm sorry to say that, because one of the filmmakers used to make great films. But I don't know. This just drives me absolutely crazy. And I don't know. It's just...
88?
Yeah, he's 88 and he's still making movies.
God. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, he's not... you know, it's one of these things where, yes, like there were themes in his movies where like the middle-aged guy, you know, having a much younger girlfriend. And yes, it was weird. And in Manhattan, the, you know, middle-aged guy played by Woody Allen is dating Mariel Hemingway, who is a high school student. It's weird. Okay. It is weird. But that pathology is a different pathology than molesting a 7-year-old, which is what Mia Farrow accused him of doing. And the backstory you just wouldn't believe it. You know, there is somebody in the Farrow family who is a child molester, and that's John Farrow, Mia Farrow's brother, who has been in prison. I don't know if he's still in prison, but really? Went to prison for a very long time for child molestation.
Wow.
Yes. I mean, on and on and on. If anybody who wants to learn more about this should read Moses Farrow's statement from 2018. So Moses is one of Mia Farrow's 13 children, I think, or 14, most of them adopted. And he just talks about the real story and what it was like growing up in that house. And he talks about what was going on the day where supposedly Woody Allen molested 7-year-old Dylan in the attic. And and it's just Mia Farrow wanted to get back at Woody for taking up with Sun Yi, and he had made his bed perfectly by, you know, having these storylines in his movies, and, you know, people were already inclined to think the worst of him, and he kind of made his bed. But it's so dispiriting that this still goes on about Woody Allen, and people are just adamant about it and not interested in hearing anything else. But Moses's statement is quite powerful.
It's just, why can't we pretend like we don't, you know, if there's no legal charge,
He was investigated by the state of Connecticut and, or, you know, New Haven.
And they found nothing?
No.
Then just let it go. Right?
Well, believe women.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, I don't know the story. I don't know much about Woody Allen. He looks weird to me, but that doesn't mean anything. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I have the same opinion here that I do with the Andrew Huberman, which is that,
yes,
look, but that we don't know. We just don't know. It's really easy to make a story sound real and emotionally appealing. It's really easy to get kids to believe that something is real, especially when they're really young.
Yeah.
They are very easily influenced, and it's just, We should take what the police have to say and believe that, you know, and if there, when there are criminal charges, we should say something about that. Or if there's, I mean, I wonder what you would say in the sense of like, when it comes to something like this, the fact that it got out at all, to me, it feels like, okay, somebody had something to gain from it getting out at all, if indeed he's so powerful. You know what I mean? And I start to view the whole thing as kind of suspicious.
Well, it was a custody dispute, first of all. So anytime there's a child abuse allegation in the context of a custody dispute, you have to, you know, take a real skeptical
eye. I know somebody who was framed in this way.
Yeah, like, no, it happens all the time.
I work with some, it was exactly this. It was just like a perfectly like a norm, like a, actually a really good guy, really good guy. Wife wanted to leave him for somebody else, partially because of his lack of faith. And so she, you know, she concocted this, he molested my child story. The child never repeated it, but she was too young. And so he went through hell. And eventually, I think he does now have custody. But it ruined his life, and he, you know, lost his job, he lost his home, he lost everything. Nobody believed him. It was this horrible situation, and he, you know, loved his kid, and it was painful being separated from his kid and having these like visits that had like a person,
that's,
you know,
right.
Like,
yeah, no, they had moderator, supervised visits, and the court, the family courts strongly favor women in these cases. This does have, you know, this is one of these things, I think it's like, as you get older, you do see just how terrible adults are capable of behaving. I mean, I think when I was 20, if someone had said, women accuse men, women make false accusations against men in court all the time, I would have said, oh, you're a sexist. That's wrong. That never happens. Well, it does happen. I mean, I have no doubt that Dylan Farrow believes she was molested by Woody Allen. Mia Farrow told her so. And, you know, many other members of the family told her so. But Mia Farrow is not a reliable narrator. I mean, three of those kids died, at least two by a parent, you know, one definitely by suicide, another one probably. And a third,
crazy.
Yeah, no, I mean,
who's allowing this woman to adopt?
Well, she was a UN ambassador. She's like Angelina Jolie. I mean, she's one of these child.
Even the Angelina Jolie thing is gross. She also, why are you? You have too many kids.
Well, Mia Farrow has way more kids than Angelina Jolie, and a lot of she adopted. I mean, there's a racial component to this too, which nobody ever wants to talk about, which is that, you know, the white kids were treated a certain way, Dylan among them. And then most of the kids she adopted from South Asia, a lot of them had severe handicaps and disabilities. And, several of them were, I mean, it's not, I don't know, several, a handful definitely, were drug addicted. One of them died of AIDS. Yeah, I mean, it was just, you know, they were raised by nannies, but, you know, Mia Farrow was just considered this saint. And it was just very strange.
I think that's creepy. I think the whole thing is.
Yeah, I mean, Woody Allen is an idiot for getting involved with her in the first place. I mean, there's a certain level at which these people deserve each other.
Okay, yeah.
But it just drives me insane the way people will just absolutely turn off their brains when it comes to this. Somebody like her, Mia Farrow, is just so clearly a manipulator. And I don't know. I always say there's like a, there's a certain kind of person. If you are around people like this in your life, you get to where you can like smell them from miles away. And I think that if you just haven't been exposed to people like that, you just don't notice it. I mean, a lot of people think that Mia Farrow is like the greatest person that ever lived. But that right there should be a dead giveaway. I mean, the amount of people I know in New York who say, well, I just don't believe it. I don't believe it. I believe that Woody molested Dylan because I know Mia, and I'm telling you, she is the most wonderful person you could ever meet. She's the most. Okay. Well, like you answered your question right there. Okay.
No. Yeah.
You don't talk that way about a normal person. You know, a normal person does not have people going around saying, she is the most wonderful person who I ever met.
Yeah. And you know, it's just, I've known more wonderful people. I mean, I've known a lot of wonderful people who become victims, but they're not well known as the victim necessarily. You know, sometimes they are, but not always. And that's interesting.
Yeah. Anyway,
I guess I don't know. I'm going to continue to say I don't know how to, I don't know them.
No, we don't know. To be clear, we don't know. Nobody knows what happened. Nobody.
But he should be allowed to. I mean, I don't understand why it's still being brought up. That's the other thing. Like, if we don't know, and if the police found nothing, and there's no, like, I'm not going to have this conversation.
Because they have, I guess that because they have to, like, say that he had a movie out. I mean, he does. It is a big deal. Like, look, if this hadn't happened, Woody Allen releasing his 50th film after 50 years, that would be like the front page of the New York Times. I mean, that is like a major, major, major arts story. Mm-hmm. There would be celebrations of him. There would be film festivals. It would be like, you know, gala events at Lincoln Center and the Kennedy Center. He would be getting awards. And, you know, instead, when he dies, his obituary, that's going to be in the headline that he was, you know, accused of this and that he married Sun Yi. I mean, it's just... It's frankly insulting to Sun Yi, who has said this family, this is what was going on in this family, and this is what happened. And how dare you say that I'm some kind of like Stockholm syndrome case? It's very insulting. She's an adult, so yeah.
She's in her 50s now.
Yeah, they've been married for 26 years.
Oh my gosh.
So
okay.
Anyway,
you feel better. Got it out. But
you know what? I got a rant about Woody Allen at least once a quarter.
Have you ever met him?
No. I would love to. I've seen him and Sun Yi a few times walking around.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad. I think we've cleared his name for good.
Yeah. Now it's taken care of.
Yeah.
This is his big redemption. Special place in hell. You've been exonerated by Sarah and Megan.
All right. Everybody, rain review, please, please, please.
Yeah, please.
If you appreciate it. Anywhere where you get your podcast, just like rate it. Just say 5 stars. These girls, amazing. Always fighting for what's right.
That's right.
The underdog. The
somebody has to do it. They do a job that no white man will do.
Yeah. No one in their right mind would do. That's for sure. No one with a cultural capital left. No one with another opportunity.
Right. All right.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay. Bye.